Tuesday.
Welcome back to the Space Case Sarah Show with the space nerds Kavi and Benjamin and our special guest, Astro Laura, who is joining us from the land down under with Kavi. And she is an astrophysicist who uses radio telescopes. And she explained in her first segment, a little bit about her educational background and origin story. We asked the important question, so she is not scuba certified. That's unfortunate. And Benjamin has a good list of questions that he wants to ask you. And I also took I took a quiz, and it's on how stuff works. It says, how much do you know about supernovas? And I started out strong, and then it kept getting worse as I was going down. I was like, dang, I don't know a lot. So I learned a lot very rapidly. I have this still here. But Benjamin, why don't you start with some of your questions, since you are just burning, pun intended, with questions.
No, I'm not going to start.
Do it.
All right. Why? No, that's a stupid question. Forget that.
Why is a Do very it. Good question.
Why?
Why?
So, supernovas, why? what was I going to say? What is the closest? All right, here's the actual question. What is the closest an object can get, a celestial object, to going supernova, but without actually crossing that tipping point that makes it go kablammo? What's the biggest it could get?
Also think, quickly before you answer that too, could you, because again, I always try to assume that people have no idea what we're talking about. Could you just briefly explain what a supernova is, and then go ahead to that question?
Sure, yes.
And use the unit of measurement is eagles.
Okay. We round up to turkeys if we need to.
Yes, many, many eagles. So many eagles.
Many eagles big.
So yeah. Many. How many shrieks of an eagle would a supernova sound like?
Well, it depends on what the environment is. I mean, I'm always going to treat all the science questions seriously. It depends on what it's exploding into.
Perfect. So yes, as you can guess, a supernova is an explosion, essentially.
Yes, it's definitely an explosion. So I get this question a lot. When is the sun going to go supernova? And that's an important question, because the answer is no, it is not. It's not going to do that. Mm-hmm. Only big stars. So stars that are about 10 times as heavy as our sun. We don't really have a very nice clear line of exactly this mass, but big stars. As they go on in their life, they're burning all the fuel that's inside them, starts with hydrogen, gets to helium. Eventually, we go up the periodic table, as this podcast does too, and we get to iron. And that's sort of the limit. Once you get to iron, fusion just is like, nope, can't take it anymore. We've got to the highest limit. That's it. And iron is also really heavy. So eventually the star sort of stops burning fuel in its core, and it starts burning fuel in sort of rings around the core. And eventually it's just like, nah, can't do it anymore. And basically gravity then starts winning. So stars around, because this fusion is pushing outwards and gravity is pushing inwards. And at this point, when fusion just conks out, gravity wins and it all just starts collapsing in on itself. But stars are really big, so there's kind of a weird delay between when the core starts collapsing and the outside doesn't really know that the inside has started collapsing. And it all bounces off this core in the middle as a big explosion, and we get these supernova remnants, which are these sort of bubbles blown in space with this explosion. So basically it's a star, a really big star at the end of its life, that with a really heavy core, everything falls in and then explodes outwards as well. That's a supernova. I was thinking, what's the closest that something can get without going supernova? And I suppose there's probably some of those stars that are on the edge of that mass, that mass edge that we don't know, between when it sort of just cools down and becomes a dwarf. So the other option is a small star does the same thing. It fusion. But instead of this big explosion, it just sort of slowly cools down in a bit of a boring end instead. So there's probably a few stars that are on the edge of that boundary, that roughly 10 solar mass boundary between, am I going to explode or am I just going to die slowly?
There's like metaphors in there. There are
we can
a ton
all
of
relate
metaphors.
To that.
Yeah, like we all feel you, stars. Exactly. So her answer conclusively was, I don't know.
Yes. Yes, the answer is definitely we don't know. That's going to be a very common answer. And if you've had other scientists, that's probably a very common answer. But those stars that die slowly, they're the most common in the universe. They're called M dwarfs. And they're, if you pointed a star, probably an M dwarf.
Okay.
Really? Cool. Mm.
Very cool. Yeah. And I, that limit that you are mentioning is named after, isn't it? It was in my quiz. Hold on.
Oh, I don't even know this.
I think you might be thinking of the type 1a supernova limit, which is a whole other story.
No, it's a type 2. Mm-hmm. It says stars that reach the...
Chandrasekhar.
Let's not talk about the types. Yeah, I'm so confused by the types. So I think if anybody knows anything about astronomy, we have a lot of historical things that now no longer make any sense at all.
Okay, what, so yeah, it's the Chandrasekhar.
All the kinds of novas?
Yes.
It's very simple. Everything is clearly type 1 or type 2.
Obviously. Except then there's one A and 2B and what is happening?
Thank you. Okay, well, that makes me feel better because I'm taking this list and they're like, what kind of types are these? Like, what causes a type 1? What causes a type 2? What is this? And I'm like, I don't know. Like, supernova. And I think that was one of Benjamin's questions as well is like, so you, like, it's nova, supernova, hypernova?
Ooh,
like, hypernova. What are the... Like, or yeah. I don't know. I think that was a hyper. What are the differences between all the novas? And is there a possibility of a super duper nova?
Yeah, I read about a kilo nova in an article just the other day.
I'm like, yes, as with all things,
we're very novas at once?
Creative naming systems.
Right.
Just add different superlatives to the start of the name until you run out and then make up new ones, I guess. That's what we do. A nova is sort of a mini explosion instead. So this is typically just the surface of a star might just explode out. So instead of the whole star exploding, there's often a little trigger or something. So maybe something from its companion, if it's in a binary, might have fallen onto the surface of the star, and that's sort of a bit of a spark and the whole surface just goes. So you can have one thing doing multiple novae. But a supernova happens once, because once you've exploded the star, there's no going back from that. Whereas novae, you can do a few, and they're known ones where you can sort of go, okay, it's probably going to go off soon-ish, but we don't really have a watch for these things. Hypernovae, I'm not so sure about that one. That sounds interesting. Killer novae, I think, are just sort of a size thing, and they could be related to fast radio bursts, which is one of the things that I study specifically. And those are the ones that I think they make some of the really cool elements. I couldn't tell you exactly which ones, but killer novae specifically are responsible for some of the certain elements that we know and love. And supernovae as well, of course, are responsible for lots of those elements, because it's in that explosion that things are kind of forced together that they otherwise wouldn't be. So I think gold might be one of the ones that is made in some of these explosions. That's usually the one in the headlines, I think.
Yeah.
But I don't know about hypernovae. Bobby, do you know about hypernovae? I don't know about
that. Okay, I found
heard
it in
the term. I think it's just when you have a higher mass star and then... I think.
Bigger?
I got the answer.
Oh,
yeah.
Oh.
So it says a hypernova is essentially a supernova, but with a much greater release of energy. Some hypernovae release deadly gamma radiation.
That sounds about right. Just add another. It's bigger, so we'll call it hyper, because that sounds cooler.
Yeah.
Right. Well, this is like... Yeah, how everything is named, you know, when you think about even like dark matter and dark energy, they're like, well, we can't tell what's there. What is it? Let's call it dark, because
we can't be expected to be good at science and be creative.
Well, you know? Yes, I mean, it's all of our telescope names, Very Large Array, the giant meteor radio telescope. It's just make it big.
I have a question that you might not know the answer to, and I don't want to take away from Benjamin's burning questions, but when you're saying very large telescope, someone told me a fact, and I can't find anything on this, that they said that like historical telescopes, big telescopes, can only earn the title of great if someone got hurt while using them. I was like, she said that she had heard it on a tour somewhere of some like historical, I don't know.
I'm trying Speaking to think of names. Has great in them. I don't think there are any microscopes with great in them. They are all great.
I don't know.
But
such a great thing, though.
Yeah. No. No. Anyway, Benjamin, what else do you have?
Oh.
Yeah. I'm putting you on the spot again. Come on. Burning right. questions.
Sure. Sure. Okay. Okay.
Just make it a good one. You know?
No pressure.
All right. Are there different types? Are there certain types of galaxies that produce more supernovae than others, like with a higher frequency, like perhaps a denser galaxy or maybe a spiral galaxy versus a cluster?
Yes. Kind of thing? Yes. The answer to that question is yes. So younger galaxies typically have more dust and gas in them, and they're also more star forming. So more dust and gas means that more stars are being born. Typically, that means that more big stars, more short-lived stars are being formed, so then we have more explosions. So if more stars are being formed, we have more explosions. The older dwarf galaxies, like our Magellanic Clouds, those little old ones that our galaxy is eating, they don't have as much dust and gas, and the stars and things in them tend to be old, so they're not really doing much. So it's the spirals with lots of stars being formed that typically have more explosions.
So the astrobiology nerd in me is like, so is that then increasing the probability of potential life forms in those galaxies if there's more explosions because there's more of the elements, from what we understand, needed for life being produced in those galaxies?
Yeah, I mean, I think I'd have to do some maths to properly answer that question. But on the other hand, of course, you don't want to be close to explosions. And also life That's takes true. A while to get going. So if we have a lot of stars that are being formed and then dying, then maybe that doesn't give enough time for life to really
right.
go. You kind of want the boring stars, I think.
Yeah.
This is it, okay. My biology is not. I did love biology in school. I loved it, but it's a little bit outdated now. But there's a lot of interesting, and that's something that I work on, is searching for stars that you maybe wouldn't want to live next door to because they have lots of these kind of flares and X-rays and being bombarded. But on the other hand, there's these ideas that maybe you do need a little bit of a explosion or some gamma rays or something to get life going. So you want that balance right. between too many explosions, not so good. But you need at least a little bit of exploding to get things going. But that's just one of many ideas on the whole life question. So a bit of sure. maybe a little bit of both.
And it might be something in the Drake equation that I am not familiar with, because I know of the Drake equation, but don't ask me to be like, this is what it all measures and you know, calculates for the statistical probability of
well, even know, the Drake life. Equation, though, the uncertainties on each of those parameters are so huge, you can basically choose whatever number you like. So it's a good way to sort of frame your thinking about these things, but not so good at getting an exact any kind of exact number out, because it just like we were talking then, there's too many things to kind of go, wait, maybe this, but maybe not that. And what if we need a little bit, but not too much? So it gets a little, it gets very complicated very quickly.
Sure. Yeah. So you are interested in the not happy stars, the bad stars, if you will, the stars that probably a spacecraft even should not get too close to.
Yes, that's right. Because our sun, hopefully, most people have heard that it flares and that causes nice aurorae and it looks cool. If it flares too much in our direction, hopefully it doesn't do that, because all of our satellites are going to be really not happy with that sort of situation yeah. as we go into the active period of our sun. So hopefully, fingers crossed that none of those spots are pointing directly at us. We'll see how we go. But the sun, our sun, you know, if we put our telescopes, you know, even at the next star over, it doesn't look that exciting. It's a pretty standard star, which is lucky for us astronomers because it's a nice sort of control. We like it. Because it's handy for understanding other stars. But the stars that I'm looking at, they do these humongous flares, so we can detect them even though they're really, really far away, particularly in the radio. So that means that if we see them in the radio, they're probably also sending out big chunks of plasma, loads of X-rays, maybe gamma rays. That's the one sort of type of light I don't tend to look into. So if you were on a planet going around these, you're probably not really in the best place to be, unless your planet has an amazing magnetic field, because that's what protects us. And the problem with these stars as well is they're smaller. So what we call the Goldilocks zone, where it's not too hot and not too cold, I think it should be called the baby bear zone. I'm on a campaign because he was the one who that had the porridge that was the correct temperature. Goldilocks was the thief. Should be the baby bear. I'm pushing
it. That's a good
point.
Yeah, but these stars, because they're small, that also means that Goldilocks zone is much closer in. So if that star has magnetic fields, then the planet might actually be inside them. So this Goldilocks zone, not too hot, not too cold, and liquid water, that's our sort of usual criteria. But there's all these other things, magnetic fields, flares, and that's the sort of thing that I'm interested in. So radio stars typically have big magnetic fields and flares. So if you put a planet in there, maybe not the best place.
You never know.
Yes,
you know, we actually and I would say that NASA Astrobiology would be with you on this campaign to get rid of the Goldilocks zone, but their reasoning is different. They don't like people thinking that there's only one specific place that life could exist, because now we understand that, like, there are extremophiles that are living in places on Earth that are so, like, we had no idea that things could survive in those places. Could they possibly then be existing on, you know, icy moons of Jupiter or Saturn? So I know that, like, that's something frowned upon even in that organization, to call it the Goldilocks zone. So we'll go for, we'll help you in your campaign for baby bear. I'm with it. We got to make t-shirts.
Baby bear.
We're going to get there. We'll get there for you. We're going to take a break and we will continue talking about stars that go boom. Can that just be the name of this episode now?
Iron Man. Stars that go boom.
Stars that go boom.
You are listening to the Space Case Sarah Show with my space nerds, Kavi and Benjamin, and our guest, Astro Laura, here on iRock Space Radio.